Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 145, and it is the first of a series of THU podcasts that I did. And let me explain this a little bit for those of you who may not know. I did a ton of podcasting. I actually didn't do podcasting. I did interviews at THU for THU TV. And Andre, who's very kind, let me take all of that and be able to turn them into podcasts for you guys. Each one of the podcasts is 25 minutes, or each one of the interviews is 25 minutes. And so I take two of those and turn that into one podcast. Sort of tried to pair them up that way. But also, because I did a ton of them, I think I did something like 16 of these. I'm not going to sort of just every week give you guys a bunch of interviews from THU. I'm going to sort of scatter them out throughout the thing, which I think will be a lot of fun. So there's two parts of it, and I want to cover it real quick. The first one is with Ian Spriggs, you guys may know. And Ian works at Oat Studios with Neil Blomkamp, and we talked to him. And he's also a member of Digital Human League. The other one is Scott Eaton. And Scott Eaton is an amazing person in the world of anatomy and CG and a bunch of other things. He's got a great site called Bodies in Motion, and we talk about that. Then part two is going to be Phil Wang and Steve Wang and Phil Liu. Steve used to work with Ian over at Oats. He's good friends with Ian, but he's now working over at the Coalition. He's in a game thing, and he's a concept artist. Another concept artist, Phil. Phil works over at Monolith Productions, and they're both kind of in the game industry. And that was really an interesting discussion as well. So that's going to be. So I'm going to go ahead and let us know what you think about that. But Lon is here with me because there's a couple of cool things that happened. We should first explain why this podcast is coming out a day late.
Yeah, I mean, we've been on the road a little bit lately. You were at THU for a while, and then I was at State of Art Academy in Venice.
Which, yeah, how was that?
Oh, it was amazing. It's also strange, you know, the way the world works sometimes. It was the second time being in Venice this year.
In 1 year, yeah.
Right? this time, though, you know, the conference was right outside, so we had it in one chance to get into Venice, and mm-hmm. I played tour guide to David.
Nice.
And gave him the, you know, my 4 hour, like, this is everything about Venice. Which, you know, culminated in a magical boat ride back to the train station and into the hotel.
But awesome.
We, for those of you who don't know, State of Art Academy is in Venice. They're located in Venice, and mm-hmm. they're a great training center for V-Ray as well as Corona and Unreal. And they've put together this conference now, I think, for 7 or 8 years, and it's really great. Amazing ArcViz speakers, and we had an opportunity to demonstrate some of the work that we've been doing in VR, which is always cool because, you know, you get to see firsthand what people's reactions are when they see this incredibly realistic, you know, ArcViz VR, and you see their mouths drop. But right. So that was really, really cool. Then we were just in Houston, which is some of your old stomping ground.
Yeah, graduated from Rice University 20 years ago.
So we were there for the American Society of Architectural Illustrators, yeah. and that's actually an international society.
Yeah, which you are the president of now.
I'll be taking over this year as a president. It's a nonprofit organization, and just amazing illustrators, and it's a passion of mine. It's a long time passion of mine. Mm-hmm. So it's great to be there. The conference this year was in Houston. It was put on by Corey Harper, who's the president, also the founder of Tilt Pixel.
Yeah.
And
I did a podcast with Corey and Rami too. So
they did an amazing job of everything. Mm-hmm.
It was a great conference.
And you had a chance to speak, which was an awesome presentation.
It was interesting because I was kind of joking about it. I was like, what should I talk about these guys? And I was joking. It's like, maybe I should talk about digital humans because obviously it seems like something I'm doing that has no relationships to architectural illustration. But that is exactly what I did talk about.
Yeah. And the correlation, the parallels that you brought from human portraiture to computer graphics of people was a direct, I think, correlation to what's happening.
And we should note that they actually, a lot of what I talked about was Ian Spriggs' work, who actually Ian gave me the blessing to use his work, because Ian Spriggs' work specifically, I feel, has a relationship in terms of going back to the old masters and understanding things. And if you look at ASAI, they have the same thing. They have incredible masters of architectural illustration, and the younger guys could learn from that process.
Oh, absolutely. So that was, we were there for a few days. Some of my favorite moments, we got to walk through your old architecture. So Chris walks into the architecture building after 20 years and of course walks right up to one of his old professors, and it was like, you know, no time had passed. They just started talking again. And,
yeah, that's John Kasbarian. Yeah.
Which I just found awesome. And then we had a chance to go to one of your secret locations in Rice University.
For those of you who are from Rice and listen to this, it was Valhalla. We just went across the street to your to the nonprofit graduate student bar.
Yeah. So that was a cool place. And then, of course, we had an opportunity to go see one of the famous ice houses, the West Alabama Ice House.
It's the oldest one in Houston, at least. Yeah, I think it is still.
And it happened to be in a night when the Houston Astros tied up the series with the Yankees, so the energy was unbelievable.
Yeah, it was really cool.
But anyway, so now we're back from ASAI.
Some announcement happened while we were there that we should probably let people know about from Adobe.
Yeah, so something else that we've been working on, and I'm really excited about this, Adobe released with their Creative Cloud 2018 package a new program called Dimension. Mm-hmm. Previously, it was called Project Felix while it was in beta. Mm-hmm. But this is a super simple, very easy to use 3D application that's meant for people that have almost never touched 3D before. You know, basically bringing 3D to people that are more familiar with 2D. And under the hood, the rendering engine is V-Ray. So, you know, it's exciting to get V-Ray in the hands of, you know, potentially millions more people in this super easy, simple way. And, you know, look out for Dimensions. Most, if you're already using a 3D program like Max or Maya or something like that, it's way too advanced. You know, this isn't meant for you, but.
No, but it's an interesting idea. I think people should, even if you are a hardcore 3D person, right, that don't necessarily look at this as a replacement for Max, like you
no,
say.
No, no, not at
but
all.
But look at it in terms of the concept.
In fact,
of
you
it.
Can't even model or anything like
right,
that.
Right, but just a concept of it isn't really interesting because. One of the things that fascinates me, and Vlado was actually the one who remarked it, is like, this is pretty good. You give it a photograph, and it creates a machine-learned HDR of the entire lighting of the entire scene of the thing for you.
A 360-degree, so interpolates a 360-degree HDR just from a stock photo.
Right.
Which is, it's pretty smart.
It's really smart.
The machine learning.
And it puts the ground in there for you and everything.
Yeah, and it can automatically align to the perspective in the ground. It's got some pretty cool tools.
Yeah. I mean, they're tools that make the person that doesn't know 3D makes their life easier. But if you think about it as an actual 3D artist, there's like, wow, that's really smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's our other exciting news that we've got cooking.
So V-Ray is the renderer of Dimension. So you guys should definitely check it out if you're interested in that. All right. Well, that's a big long intro, and that's a lot of news that we had, which was great. Hopefully, you guys will enjoy this awesome THU podcast that I did, and there'll be many more to come, probably scattered throughout the next 6 months or more. All right, thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays. In high dynamic range, we know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I'm here with Ian and Scott, I want to talk to you guys mainly why I thought it would be great to bring you two guys together is to really talk about the human form and representing humans, because that's a subject, as you know, it was something that I'm interested in talking about when I do the Wiki Human project. But I think there's a lot of things that people can take away that you guys can offer to let them know about what's important when they're representing human forms. So I want to start with faces, okay? Because this is something that you and I have been working on the WikiHuman project. Right. You did an incredible presentation on portraits, right?
Yeah, thank you.
And what was great about your presentation is the amount of reference you use from art.
That's right, yeah.
So actual art, classical art, right?
Yeah.
So tell me specifically what your goal was when you said art, you know, has a timeless feeling to it when a painting does.
Yeah.
And why can't CG characters have the same timeless feeling to them?
This is exactly right. Like a Rembrandt painting you'll see, which was painted hundreds of years ago, but you still connect with it because it's got like a human emotion which you can connect with, whereas like digital stuff, you kind of, some of the tools and programs kind of get in the way of right. that, I find. And it's like, if you have a portrait done 5 years ago, you can almost tell it's done 5 years ago. So I feel like my goal is to try and like get over that, so you don't actually see when it was created.
Right.
So it's like, if you're using Marvelous Designer, it's like, you shouldn't be able to tell what program you used to make the artwork.
Right.
It's just, the artwork should stand by itself.
Yeah, or say like, oh, that uses this rendering engine, or that uses this, whatever it is. That's not the point of it, right?
No, they're just tools.
They're just tools.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but what you do is you spend a lot of time studying art history to look at specific things of portraiture.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's an important tool to do to make sure that you're human forms are represented in a way that makes sense. It's not just a T-pose, right? Because that will definitely give it away to this CG. But Scott, you also look at a lot of...
Maybe the T-pose is actually the relevant thing to place it in chronological time, though.
Yeah,
like art,
I guess so.
Represents the period that it's created in, right? And that's something that honesty in art is about, you know... The topic of the day, it's all the references that are brought in to make it. And like, I'm not actually saying people should do this in a T-pose, but yeah, that is
the T-pose definitely does represent something.
It does. It represents this era in 21st century kind of art tool production.
Well, to be honest, they did represent the T-pose a lot.
A long time ago.
Jesus Christ is always represented in classic T-pose.
Exactly. Or the Vitruvian Man.
Right.
Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. But anyway, sorry about that.
No, that's clear. I'm glad.
Who's listening, don't do T-poses. because I don't think it actually makes for good art. I was just playing the devil's advocate.
Yeah. But known, well, I know you as the person that really understands anatomy, has taken a lot of time to look at anatomy and understand that. And that's an important part of, what Ian and I have been had a conversation for the last 2 years about is about the human face and emotion and the uncanny valley and all those things.
Sure.
But those are things that are represented in the face, but the anatomy and the way that a body is put together is an incredibly important thing. So tell us a little bit about the work that you've done in that field.
Well, it's kind of an ongoing life's work to kind of deepen my own understanding of anatomy. It's become kind of an obsession, and it's something that I teach widely, and I learn from the students that I teach, deepens my knowledge even more, just kind of reframing how I think about it. But it's kind of the prerequisite for representing the figure in whatever way you do it, in my opinion. That it's, I say this in all my talks, but it's like the vocabulary of figurative art. You know, if you don't understand the nouns and the verbs of the body, then you're gonna have a hard time putting together a composition, you know.
But it also does things like make sure you have the right proportions,
exactly. And I mean, there's a hierarchy of representation, the thing about the body and the face is that, I mean, at the core structures, it's mechanical, right?
Right.
It's a machine, really. I mean, we have soft actuators and, impulses actuate them, and we run on carbohydrates and things. But really, it's a machine, right? It's levers and pulleys and actuators, and so there's just a lot of complexity to it. I mean, probably more complexity than we can create mechanically.
Right.
Like it's talking about robots or things. We don't have the sophisticated structures that we've evolved biologically to make robots of similar proportions yet. It's to represent it. I mean, to understand it kind of medically is one thing. Like, I think we probably kind of sussed out musculoskeletal anatomy almost completely for 100 years, right?
Okay.
Like, but artistically to represent it, or technologically to re-implement it, like even in CG, with the most sophisticated rigs and computer graphics, really, really hard, really big challenge still.
Yeah, I think it's what's interesting about it is that You mentioned robotics, right?
Sure.
And it's the same thing with the body and the face. The Uncanny Valley graph actually comes
from robotics, yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so that graph, for those of you who may not know about it, is about the representation of humans and whether you have a positive or negative response to that. And the closer, the argument that was done for robotics, and this was done in the 1970, I believe, was that the closer a robotic entity looks to a human, the more positive response you get until it's very close, but not close enough, and you get a very negative response. And that's what they call the Uncanny Valley. But it is a thing where, like, if the motion doesn't look quite right, it's the same problem.
Yeah,
right?
Yes, animation probably definitely suffers in the Uncanny Valley.
Right.
When you know that it's an attempt to...
It exaggerates that valley. The chasm gets deeper, right?
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about your history, Ian, and then we'll talk about yours as well. I just want to bounce back and forth, if that's okay. What sort of got you, I remember you told an amazing, well, it wasn't even a, part of your talk, it was part of the Q&A, where people were asking you about art school.
Yeah.
And how art school was sort of, even though you're such an incredible artist, you felt like you failed at art school.
Yeah, a little bit. Like, I definitely had a passion towards doing representational work, but I think the art school really pushed me towards just expression. And it's just like, to get rid of all representational and just do expressional work. And it's like my heart is...
Why do you feel that art schools did that?
I'm not sure exactly. I feel like they thought it was like, this is the new wave of... This is the new arts, like the more expressional work. Mm-hmm. But I feel like for me, it's like more... Like we can't lose track of where we came from. Like, because portraiture has been done for all of history, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it anymore. We have new tools to do it, so we should still explore what we're doing. Because we've done portraiture since like caveman times, where people would do like those caveman drawings on the walls. That's a representation of a human.
Right.
So it's like we always want to use the latest tools to represent the human figure.
Right.
And I feel like art school's kind of like, well, let's get away from that a little bit and not represent the like, true representation, but express more of the internal self.
Right.
So I do a little, I try to combine a bit of both. Still. I still want to show the expression as well as the representation.
Yeah, I think it's what was interesting is that obviously you also were mentioning the fact that you know you have two brothers.
That's right.
They're both in the creative field, right? You're David, I believe.
Yeah, David's the installation artist.
He's the installation artist, and so that is you know, and it's much more of a contemporary art thing. It's beautiful work, by the way. But it is interesting and. Different, and then obviously Richard is also an animation director, right?
Animation supervisor.
Supervisor at MPC. Yeah. Okay, and so he's the one who got you into 3D, right?
That's right. Yeah. I was so after art school, I was like, I wasn't really sure what my direction was,
right?
And I was like drawing, sketching a lot, and I realized that it's like the human figure is what I love, and it's like representational work is what I love, and then Richard was just like, why don't you just go to 3D? Like go to Seneca in Toronto. And as soon as he said that, it was like a button just clicked in my head. I was
right.
Like, of course.
Yeah.
This is what I meant to do.
And you've done some incredible work. You did your talk that I went to yesterday sort of had the timeline of your portraits as they progressed and the relationship you did. And what I loved about it is I basically got to hear your story of you and your family as we moved along this timeline of every portrait you make and then your work, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it was really kind of a beautiful thing, and I think it was really great to sort of see that story happen.
I had a conversation with Scott this morning. He said it was great to see them all together. I'm thinking of each portrait as like a separate piece in itself, but Scott was like, well, if you put them all together, then I can see you as an artist.
Right.
And then you see the style. And you
Yeah, because that first and last frame of your presentation was all of those portraits.
That's right.
Yeah, but to see it as a body of work is really special.
Right.
Because any single one, you kind of understand.
Right.
You kind of understand the goal and the intention. But when you see 12 in a sequence, you can't help but understand the intention. Because they're coming from the same artist and it's the same process. Yes. And then it's really powerful. And then I felt like I got a lot of insight looking at them as a group because I'd only seen them individually before.
Right.
but seeing them together was really, really special.
Yeah, because like one of them individually, you don't know if it's like a happy accident or...
Yeah, or just a one-off, yeah, you know, exactly. And that's... One-offs are cool, and they're, sometimes they're really impressive, but to see it, to see that that's the consistent style and the consistent treatment and the same consideration, the same thoughtful consideration to composition in each one, you know, it becomes evident that there is something deeper than just a rendering.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah. I think it was very successful. I was extremely happy to see that talk.
Cause, oh, thank you.
It was really great. And I've been a fan of your work for a long time. Digital humans is something that's very important to me.
Yeah.
I think there is a very special role they get, but I will talk that a little bit later because I want to ask your opinion about it.
Sure.
But let's go. You and I were on the beach a few days ago,
yeah.
being tortured.
Yeah.
But while we were coming back, we had a long conversation. You told me a little bit about your history and how you've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah. You know, how far back did we go? Remind me.
We were talking about. The dial-up modems and doing some stuff there, but then I think you said you first started doing CG on SGIs, is that right? Or
My background is, I have a love for figurative drawing and art since I was a kid,
right?
some you know, like fifth grade it was sparked for me by another kid who came into class and was amazing, and I kind of wanted to do amazing stuff since then. Yeah, aspirations for comic books and inspiration from comic books and all sorts of things. But then I studied engineering in college because I had good talent for math and science, and I did enjoy it. Yeah. I enjoyed both math and science.
I was an art and math major.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of us that are like that, and it's just kind of an inseparable thing about me. But when I was doing engineering, we had, you know, Silicon Graphics reality engines,
right,
in the computer lab. And I remember very clearly the exact moment that I fell in love with computer graphics. And
okay.
That was going in for like one of our like programming lessons. Mm-hmm. And they were showing us what the reality engine could do. And they had a sphere, mm-hmm, on the screen, projected on the wall in front of us. And it had a chrome environment map, right?
So
reflection map. And somebody just like with the mouse, he just plucked one of the vertices and pulled it out and let it go.
And reflections
just propagated the waves over the surface, and the reflections warped. And like, oh my God, surrealistic. Surrealistic. And then to put it in context, this was like, we were doing like GL programming before it was even OpenGL.
Right.
And we were, you know, it was like making polygons, you know, like coding polygons by putting the vertex coordinates in and things like that.
Were you using Wavefront or?
No, I mean, we're just like writing in C.
Writing in C.
It was interesting, but thinking back, it was awful.
Right.
You know, like I would not want to replicate that experience.
Right.
Pretty low fidelity, but it was really like magic, you know, because it was a thing. I could see this thing that was, I love to make pictures, you know, pen and ink, drawing, you know, sculpting a little bit. And then I'm like, wow, this is really interesting tech,
mm-hmm,
possibilities artistically, you know, and obviously it wasn't ready for prime time, like art production by a long shot. I mean, but, you know, I kept following it and kept track of it. And Maya 0 came out, Maya 1, whatever you want to call it. And that was cool. And that was a lot of potential there. And then, you know, for me as a sculptor, it started to be when ZBrush was released.
ZBrush was the watershed moment, I think, what really changed the way that people started thinking about characters.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was
hard to represent any characters before that.
You have the veterans in the CG industry that were patch modelers.
I know. And Alex Alvarez and doing all of these modeling creatures in patches. It's like, oh my gosh, what a horrible nightmare that was.
It was. Yeah. So some of us remember that. And I didn't do much with it, to be honest.
Right.
I was just kind of flirting with it, as playing around to see it. You know, like, that's way too hard. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to make anything, you know, intentional with that because it's just clumsy.
Right.
For the kind of intention that I had, having, you know, doing work in clay on the side. So it was, you know, that in ZBrush, like the first significant release was like 1.55B, I think was the name of it, if I remember correctly. That was, they had like the capabilities to sculpt 10,000 polygons.
Right.
And I like, yeah, otherwise, it was a paint package, right? The first ZBrush was just a kind of a pseudo, you know, 3D depth map package, right? The pixel technology. And but that 10,000 polygons was like amazing to sculpt on,
right?
You know, and then it just got better from there.
I remember my first character I ever modeled was just in Maya. And it's just like, it took me a month just to like push and pull vertices until it looked something like it was still. Fell right into an uncanny valley, but it's like I just couldn't get out of it. But it took me so long to figure it out.
Yeah, it's really hard to do that. There was a guy I worked with at Digital Domain. His name was Dan Platt, and he actually did a lot of anatomy classes as well. He used to work for Rick Baker back in the day. But he would literally just push pull vertices.
I remember his work.
Huh?
I remember his work. I was very inspired.
Because he did like, you know, Benjamin Button's head and all those other stuff. So he's really interesting. But it is kind of nice to have those tools now, right? I mean, those sculpting tools really kind of helped sculpt, basically,
and
make it much easier, much more intuitive. I know you're much more of a Munchbox user yourself.
Right? Yeah, Munchbox.
You like ZBrush, but just the idea.
I can't believe I'm sitting on the same.
I know
he doesn't know that.
So let me ask: is Mudbox and ZBrush actually like? Is there an animosity to it in the same way that like rendering engines?
Not between users necessarily, but and I can't actually speak for the companies.
Right, but I mean,
but maybe,
I'm just curious about it.
Maybe,
it's interesting,
maybe.
But yes, yeah, so. I think that that's really an important part of where technology sort of helped bring this stuff forward for a lot of people, right? It's when sculpting became more of a thing.
I think like when technology got better, it's the less you saw technology because it allowed the artist to be the artist.
Right.
Which I...
Do you think there are still obstacles right now?
Yeah, absolutely.
What are the obstacles in the technology that's stopping you from going, you know, as easy as possible or making more challenging?
Well, it's like when you're working for a company, it's like they always want to keep the same topology, like the same vertex count, so that you can blend between characters and stuff like this.
Right.
And then, like sometimes you want to completely change something. And it's like the work world kind of wants to keep things like a certain way, but personally, it's like you can have a lot more freedom still.
Right. So yeah, that's interesting. The idea of blend shapes, right?
Yeah.
And animations.
Yeah.
And different things like that. Blend shapes are. I'm still not convinced that blend shapes is the right way to go, in a lot of ways.
For facial expressions.
For facial expressions,
sure.
Because we for body we use mostly muscle systems, right?
Yeah.
Do you think muscle systems are going to be a way that you can animate faces? Because
well,
there's talk about it, but I haven't
seen
anything.
You know where everything's going. Everything is going towards simulation.
Simulation.
You know? I mean, and so it's. As computational power increases, I mean, blend shapes are just like a very crude method to approximate what the face does. I mean,
right.
If you have the ability to, I mean, we're going to look back on the tech that we have now in 10 years
absolutely.
And be like, what are you talking about? Blend shapes is like trivial,
well,
thing.
Yeah, I know that a lot of people are doing like literally facial capture now, right?
Yeah, well, facial capture, and then you get the people doing, you know, using that as an input to simulation
and deep learning.
To simulate the soft tissue, you know, and just the layers, you know, or for example, MRI scan the face and segment out the facial muscles and segment out the fat pads and then use that as the inputs to simulation, right? So you get full, you know, finite element simulation of soft tissue deformation and fidelity in the wrinkles and, you know, things that, you know, if and this comes back to the digital humor project, like if the goal is absolute realism, the way to get there is with data.
Yes.
You know, and that's exactly
that's
what
I'm
you guys
to.
Talk about.
Right.
That's what your project is.
And we're not necessarily going for absolute realism. We're just saying this is as good as you can do objectively, right?
Yes, but but understanding that it's sample driven as opposed to
absolutely
as opposed to artistically driven, which is the real big difference, right? When you take because a lot of times, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, and you've studied more portraiture history than I have, but a lot of times it was 19th century portraiture. There was no photography. How can we remember this person who's significant, and we'll get somebody to represent him by painting him?
Right.
Right. And so I imagine, and I, again, I don't have any statistics or any information to back this up, but when cameras came, there were a lot of portraiture artists that were out of work.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we'll take a picture of him instead.
Right.
And
it's always the ones which are the most artistic, which are remembered, though. So you get, you might get the most realism, but it's the ones which, whether the photographer is like, they add that the beauty to it.
Sure.
And those are the ones which always get passed on and remembered.
Sure. No, of course, there's always the art that, that can be injected into the process.
Right.
In the same way that, you know, what is the next evolution of capturing the face? You know, if we're talking about portraiture, it's what you're doing, right?
Right. Well, they did, the guys at ICT, they flew up to the White House and they captured Obama, and they've done a full facial scan of Obama. It's now in the Smithsonian.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So exactly. That could be the contemporary.
And they did the
portraiture.
Same thing with Lincoln, right? They actually did a plaster cast of Lincoln's face long ago. So it's not just a portraiture anymore or a painting. But even that, let's go back to your idea. They still do paintings of presidents.
Yeah. Right? They still need to present these things. Like, as an artist who needs to present it, you can't just take the scan of Obama and just be like, there we go. And it's like you still need to be able to present it to the audience in
absolutely.
A beautiful way.
Yeah, I mean, right now, and it because it's a scan, it's just bits and bytes, right?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
not actually like something tangible. Yeah. But
and that's the interesting part. Yeah. Like, when you take what it's just machines in charge of the process,
right?
Then is it really is not a piece of art? But as soon as somebody, so imagine the two endpoints, the end point where you have a perfect scan of a face with all the data and the specular maps and everything, and then you have Ian who's crafted something that maybe the end point they're exactly the same,
right?
But this has the artist's hand involved, so this becomes a piece of art.
Yeah, absolutely.
By definition.
Yeah,
it's the filter that it goes through.
We actually need to wrap it up because we've got to get to the next one. But before we go, I want to make sure that we get a chance to talk about where people can see your work. So, Scott, where can we see some of your work?
So a couple projects that I have, all my personal work and kind of my comings and goings are on, and my anatomy courses are on scott-eaton.com.
Yeah.
And then my big figure reference library, which is kind of recently launched as reference for artists and figure study, is bodiesinmotion.photo.
Okay.
And you can find it there.
Oh, awesome.
Big resource for people.
Yeah, that's great. And we talked about that site. It sounds really fascinating. So definitely go check it out, bodiesinmotion.photo. .photo, sorry.
Yeah. Don't go to the .com. He's trying to get money out of me.
Okay. All right. And then, Ian, what about your work?
But just my website, iansprigs.com. Or you can just follow me on ArtStation. I'm always posting my
work.
Oh,
yeah, are on ArtStation. Pretty great as well. Yeah, awesome. Well, cool. Well, thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Right.
This concludes part one of our first THU podcast that included Ian Spriggs and Scott Eaton. And now we're going to go on to part two with Steve Wang and Phil Liu. Hope you enjoy it.
I'm here with Steven and Phil, right? Mm-hmm. Or Steve.
Steve is fine.
Steve's cool,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
Steve's cool.
Yeah.
And he and I, it's funny, just before we started, he and I were both talking about the fact that Stephen Wang and Chris Nichols, there's several of them in the industry, and we get confused for someone else, right?
Get emails like, for other people all the time.
Yeah, right. I know, it's really, really funny. But you're now a concept artist, right?
Correct.
You're concept overs, and you're working at Oat Studios.
Currently, I'm not. Currently, I'm working at The Collision, the Microsoft gaming studio
in
Vancouver, Canada.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so what's life like in over there?
Life is great.
Yeah?
See, I love what I'm doing. It's very relaxing. Like, I just kind of jumped from Oats to Microsoft. So
right.
I went from a film in very intensive kind of schedule into Microsoft and into video game, where it was like, okay, you can get several days to do your work. You can explore with tools and in whatever techniques you want.
Right.
So I've been learning quite a bit just on my personal time, like, and with Microsoft, of course.
Right. Yeah. That's pretty awesome. What about you, Phil?
I'm currently working at a studio called Monolith Productions.
Oh, Monolith, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Working on the game Shadow of War.
Shadow of War. Okay, awesome. So you guys both working in the gaming area at this point, right?
Yep.
And what do you do over at Monolith?
I am a world artist.
You're a board artist?
World artist.
World?
It's essentially the same as the environment artist.
Oh, the world artist. Yes. Okay, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
So I get to take little pieces from, you know, concept art and then make a level out of it, and also make props, and then talking with, you know, the level designer, making sure that it's fun.
Right.
And also talking with the programmers and the tech artists to make sure that, you know, it still runs smoothly in frame rate, and also make sure it's under memory.
Right. Okay. Well, what's it like working besides those obvious things in terms of environments? It's kind of cool, I guess. You have to come up with they have to get a draft on the actual story, and then you have to figure out the entire process that someone is going to move through that space, right?
Yeah, I mean, usually that's with, you know, environment art goes in just about any studio.
Right.
It's also a fairly generic term. So as some studios, you know, artists is expected to wear more hats, whereas, you know, others, it's definitely much more specialized. Like, for example, I think Naughty Dog, if you're a texture artist, for like 90% of the time, all you do is just texture.
Right.
Whereas I think at Monolith, it tends to be a little bit more generalized.
So you get to do a little bit of everything, right? You get to do texturing and stuff like that. And what about the actual design of the lighting? How do you deal with the lighting as well?
Lighting is an interesting topic. Just because for last gen in video games, it tended to be, you know, most of the environment artists would just go in there and flip the light switch on. But especially with just, you know, how complicated the game is getting, for most of the project I've worked on for, you know, current gen, there's definitely dedicated lighting artists, you know, very similar in how, you know, it's being treated in the film industry, where I believe they generally work much closer with the art director just to kind of dictate, okay, here is the mood and here is kind of the overall feel of the entire level.
Okay, interesting. So, that sounds great. But Stephen, let's see, when you were basically, how did you get into becoming a concept artist? How did that land on you?
I actually was in product design, industrial design, and then I kind of just saw a video of Feng Zhu on YouTube one day.
Oh, yeah.
And then I was like, wow, okay, well, I guess this is kind of what I wanted to do.
Okay.
And then I went to school for a year.
Where did you go to school?
It was 2012, I believe.
No, where?
Oh, where? Singapore.
In Singapore.
Singapore. So that was, that's where he established a school. I had no choice.
Okay.
I went there for a year, and then I came back to Vancouver and basically kind of just started working. And my first few jobs definitely weren't concept art. It was a lot more like illustrative. I worked in budget animation quite a bit, where, you know, you don't actually animate or rig anything. It's more like moving layers in Photoshop and adding fog in between to make it feel like, you know, I think a lot of times I work on a game called Sacred 3, and anything that's not the main cinematic was going to use that style of animation, and we were helping them to establish that and keep it under budget. But after that, it's been just concept art, you know, concept art.
But you've been working in the game industry for a lot of it, or have you worked in the feature film as well, or you obviously did stuff?
Everything. I think I started with animation. I went into games, and then I did mobile games. I did films for the Chinese film industry for a little bit, and then I did one or two feature pitch. I didn't actually work on the full feature film, and then I went to Oats, and then after Oats, I guess Microsoft would be my first like kind of full-time in-house AAA game experience.
What was Oats like?
Oats was awesome. Oats was like, I just walked in and he completely caught me off guard because he had all these, it's almost like a giant showroom of the props that Neo collected throughout his film career,
right?
Moose, Chappie, Elysium, and all that. And what's really cool, because I'm a concept artist, so there's a bunch of Sid Mead drawing, originals framed.
Yeah.
And it's just lying in the corner. So I'm
That Sid Mead was one of the guests the first year that I came to THU.
Oh, really? Wow, they managed to get him.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. So he's a pretty interesting guy. He's a pretty interesting guy.
Yeah, but I could learn a lot from just hearing him talk. Was he talking about?
He was talking about his career and stuff, and you know, struggles of what it is. Okay. You know, he's very successful.
Oh, super.
Yeah. So he's doing really well.
I'm sure he's going down in not only design history but art history in itself. He started.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he didn't just design things for. That's the thing, right? So as both of you guys are, you know, design things and model things. He didn't just do it for films. That films was just something he did on the side. He did it for like illustrated things for car commercials or concepts of this or anything. So it was pretty interesting. So it sounds like amazing to have been there. But it's not run like a normal studio.
Oh, absolutely not. There's no hierarchy at all, right? Right. Absolutely not. It was basically you get to talk to Neo on a daily basis. Actually, no, he would talk to you regardless. Right. Like, even if you don't want to talk to him, he would talk to you.
Right.
Hey, what's going on with that concept? Right. What's going on with that? And that was really cool because the feedback was instant.
There wasn't a whole bunch of emails,
and there's no waiting time, right? Usually it could be a couple of days of waiting in normal studio, but it was instant. Or you can walk over to his desk and be like, what do you think about this, what do you think about that?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that there's no hierarchy, for example, like there's no junior concept artist and then, you know, concept artist lead and so on and so forth, means that me and, for example, Ian Spriggs, mm-hmm. He's the character artist. He's got way more experience than me. But the fact that there's no hierarchy means that I kind of talk to him like we're just buddies and we're like equal or something.
Right.
And that was a really interesting experience to me because there was no like intimidation factor.
Right.
And everyone was really like friend. Like, you go out for lunch every day. We play ping pong a couple hours a day.
Right.
And then, yeah. And these are probably, these are the friends I still keep even now I'm not at Oats anymore.
Right. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. Now, how have you been in video games the whole time?
Yeah, I've been in the game industry for about 4.5 years at this point.
Okay.
So.
And what led you there? What got you interested in it?
Well, I've always wanted to, you know, be a video game artist. Mm-hmm. Ever since, you know, growing up playing World of Warcraft, you know, Halo, and I went to a school essentially in the middle of nowhere called the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
Okay.
Yeah. And I majored in industrial design, and essentially
interesting. You both had industrial design.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yep.
It's awesome.
That's interesting.
Was it like product? More like product?
Yeah, it was definitely more product-based, but, you know, me, you know, being a huge geek at the time, you know, still am, I would spend all of my time, it's like, okay, you know, here's a assignment, whether it's like, okay, design a cup, design a toaster. I would get that done really, really quickly. I didn't care if I got a C on it. And then I would take the knowledge of, you know, drawing stuff in perspective and ortho, and I would just design guns, mechas, you know, fantasy swords,
right,
all sorts of stuff.
Very similar story. It's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, really?
It's interesting. So you were doing similar things, right?
Yeah, I was doing it to a point where the teacher told me at the time, it was like, look, your stuff's really cool, but none of this is ever going to get made in real life. So why are you in product design?
Right.
And I thought to myself, oh, yeah, you're right. Why?
Right.
And then, you know, kind of just transition out of there.
So, but you still, what were you, I mean, you still had the same tools that you guys were using in product design, and you're just like, I'm just going to keep using these tools to do things I really want to do?
I mean, for the most part, I just, you know, had, you know, pencil and paper.
Okay.
For drawing, and slowly kind of, because there was a couple of computers in the computer lab at the time that had Photoshop,
uh-huh.
And I think there was like a really, really old version of 3D Studio Max, so I would, you know, spend all my time at the lab, and it's like, oh, this is super cool, you know, I get to actually, you know, draw something like a sword, and then, you know, afterwards I get to scan it in, you know, color in Photoshop, and then, you know, like model it out in 3D, and then I think back in the day there was when, you know, CG Society was a much bigger deal, mm-hmm. I would always, you know, try to work up the courage, like, oh man, it's like, look at all these people doing all these amazing things. I would try and, you know, work up the courage, and you know, like, oh, try to say, okay, I gotta, you know, make something cool and post it. And somehow, you know, just right when I'm about to hit the cement, it's like, nah, you know, this is never gonna be good.
Right.
And so I ended up just browsing CG Society and trying to kind of look at what some of the artists were doing there. And it's like, oh, this is, you know, this person did a really cool portrait, or this person did a really cool landscape. And I'm just trying to kind of see, look at their breakdown, look at how they did it, and trying to do something similar to it. But I still remember, you know, I think I probably have one of the most long and kind of winding way of getting to the video game industry.
Okay.
Because, you know, I started off like everybody else does, like, oh, I want to be a concept artist. You know, it'd be cool to go into a video
like
game.
Like this guy.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it would be so cool to, you know, get into industry and draw an idea and get to see everybody, you know, model it and follow it. And,
yep.
You know, for a while, I think that realizing it's like, yeah, I mean, yeah, I've definitely put a lot of hard work into it, but it's probably, you know, like, it's just never going to happen at a certain rate, you know, where I need it to be improved. Like, it's like, I feel like, you know, everybody's skill was like up here, and for me to catch up, my skill was always kind of like lagging behind in a way. And so, you know, at the time, I think this is like 2009-ish. Mm-hmm. So I transferred to an actual art school, Savannah College of Art and Design,
where they had...
You know, a video game.
A lot of SCAD people.
Yeah.
They have a video game department there.
Yep.
I didn't know that.
And they also had a visual effects program as well.
Yes, I know that. Okay.
So I kind of, I was looking at some of the stuff that was being done for both film and video games. Mm-hmm. And, you know, visual effects at the time, I was like, oh man, it's like I get to, you know, put like a million polygons into, you know, Maya, and then I get to put like, you know, 8K textures. And, you know, essentially for me, there was definitely the freedom that came in with, you know, visual effects. It's like, okay, you know, here is much more of a bigger canvas I can, you know, paint stuff on. It's like I can create, you know, massive environment, super epic stuff without having to worry about how things to run at real time.
Right.
And unfortunately, this was also the time when the visual effects industry was kind of really struggling. Mm-hmm. And I remember...
How was that?
Yeah. I remember... I had an interview with Rhythm and Hughes.
Oh my
gosh. For, I believe it was a junior texture painter position.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know why, but something, this is, I mean, I don't believe in kind of fate or anything like that, but there was just something in my gut that said, don't go to that studio. Don't go to that studio. Don't go to that studio. And, you know, I'm thinking, it's like, okay, this is crazy. It's like, why not go there? But somehow, you know, I stuck to my gut. It's like, you know what? I can't take this job. So I turned them down. Mm-hmm. And then within about 6 months later, nine months, the studio shut down.
Yeah. Yeah. But you ended up working in the game industry. That's a pretty cool job, right?
Yep. So. I think it was definitely, it was an interesting timing. So after, you know, the visual effects industry went down, I was like, okay, well, I got to do something to find a job in the industry. And so I ended up, you know, building a game portfolio and then sending it out to a bunch of different companies. And I remember there was one company that got back to me and they're like, hey, we like your stuff. And, you know, here is an art test. If you do well on it, you know, you get to work on God of War Ascension.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this is super, super cool. You know, I'm going to spend like, you know, 3 weeks, you know, working my butt off and just not really attending class or doing any of the homework. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I bombed the art test in a very spectacular fashion.
Oh, that's too bad.
And you know, for a while, I was, you know, really sad. I was like, oh man, what, you know, how could this happen? You know, it's like I've spent, you know, so much time, you know, trying to make it into the industry and to get a no. But I felt like, you know, that failure in many ways kind of really prepared me for the industry better than if I just, you know, got accepted. Because I feel like, you know, it's definitely forces me to take a step back and look at my skill in a very unfiltered sort of way. And it's like, okay, where is, you know, some of the studio I want to work at? What are the level of content that they're producing? And clearly it's like, what, where is my stuff, the quality of my stuff is at? Mm-hmm. And it's all about how do I find information and bridging that quality bar.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, and I want to ask both of you guys, but I'm going to start with you, Steve. What do you think has happened in the world of, you know, where you guys are, where you're artists or 3D guys or whatever?
Yeah.
And how sites like ArtStation, for example, how does that play a role in terms of exactly what he's describing, where you gauge where you are compared to other people or other studios and get feedback and everything else?
It's almost very obvious now, right? If your stuff don't make it on our station page, our front page or whatever, it's almost like, well, then it must not be good or something.
Right.
I think it's getting
That's the case. But
it's definitely not the case. It's right. definitely not the case.
Right.
But I do think it's getting just harder and harder to compete with all the, because what Isolation brought, what Isolation did was bringing all the artists in the world into one platform,
mm-hmm.
and everyone now has this platform to show off the best of
right.
what the best work they have, right? And I also see a merge in all the disciplines, right? So now 3D, I feel 3D is getting to a point where it's easy and fast enough that 3D artists could pull off concepts, and concept artists could pull off almost production-ready 3D models. In fact, I've worked with many 3D artists that used to be 3D artists, but they just got so quick at their work, now they're concept artists, and we work together.
Yeah, well, when I worked on Tron, back in the day, yeah. David Levy, who's going to be coming up next, but nice. He's a friend of mine, and we sat next to each other.
Yeah.
He's a concept artist,
yeah.
and I was a 3C, visual effects guy, and we worked together. This is, by the way, very rare. It hardly happens, as you probably know, as a yeah. concept guy. But we worked together, and he worked in 3D. He worked entirely in 3D, and he would hand me his models or his ideas and say, try this out. Tell me if this is going to work in the scene.
Yeah.
And so we would work together that way. And but yes, some people just work. Ben Proctor was the first person that I knew who just works directly in 3D. He only used the Softimage, which is now a dead product. But
yeah.
but yeah, that's the way it was. But I think you're right. I think that the social media aspect that is involved in showing your work or understanding your work or getting the feedback is important. So, Phil, what do you think about the role that plays, and how does that help you, or do you think there's a disadvantage there in certain cases?
I think it's both an advantage and a disadvantage.
Okay.
You know, and one advantage is that, you know, with such a massive, you know, following art station, that, you know, anybody can go, like, oh, hey, you know, here is my artwork, and if it's good and people like it, then it's definitely, you know, you have a large amount of audience, you know, access to that, and
mm-hmm.
it's definitely a good way to promote your artwork,
mm-hmm.
but, like, you know, like what you said, at the same time, just the insane amount of competition that there is.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I feel like artists are always having to kind of, you know, work, you know, the extra hard, like, oh no, you know, I got to make sure that I'm always at the top of my game. You know, it's like, look at what these other artists are doing. It's like, if I slack off, or if I don't do my best, then, you know, there is definitely that fear of, like, oh no, I'm just gonna, you know, get really behind what everybody is, you know, steaming ahead.
Right. I think it's interesting to think about that the whole structure of it, the way it works. I think it does help. I think if artists who are not very good at taking things objectively, they usually take things very personally.
Yeah.
But if they did take things objectively, there's actually a massive benefit of looking at these sites, right? You get to be able to judge things. You get to comment on things. You get
yep.
to be able to make things. You get to better yourself in a lot of ways.
With online education being so prevalent, you know, with CGMA, you know, Gumroad, and, you know, a whole bunch of dozens of others, really, really, really high quality online education websites. You know, almost anybody, you know, who wants to be a character artist and be like, oh, I want to learn from a Naughty Dog character artist. Like, well, here is an online class, and it's for like $800. You know, you get to spend 8 weeks with this guy, and he will, you know, critique your stuff along the way.
Right.
And yeah, the amount of information and the availability of just some of the best artists working in the industry and willing to just, you know, sit down or, you know, online with students and critique their stuff, I think is just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I think it is important. What I also am wondering is the fact that your moment of, like, your art is, like, only important for, like, a few days.
You know? A couple seconds almost. If you're on Instagram, it's like, scroll, oh, okay, kind of like it. Double tap, like, there you go, scroll to the next post.
Yeah,
so
and all that work just gets sort of sucked into it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, like, for example, I'm a huge fan of Ian's work,
yep.
Ian Spriggs, as you know, and I was going to Andre. I say, Andre, you gotta see this guy's work. It's amazing. Yep. He's like, this is incredible. And so that's why I invited him. But that's the, like, one of the only places where I actually go to. I'll one better at. We actually printed out all of his images. He gave us the high res,
okay.
and it's hanging in our office. We have an Ian Spriggs wall of his family.
Wow, you know? That's awesome. Does he know that?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're fantastic. But that's a rare thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Most people don't do that. You're right. That Instagram like thing is interesting.
But it's good though. Like, I mean,
well, at the same time, there's a ton of stuff being made, right?
There is, and you get to see it. Sometimes it might be bad for just being original or creative because you're seeing all these content, and it somehow just kind of makes its way into the back of your head. So that when you're drawing, you're creating, you kind of look at it and be like, oh, wait, I saw this like for 3 seconds yesterday and I really liked it. And that's probably why it kind of looks like that.
Right.
But I like Instagram, Facebook, especially ArtStation. I mean, I'm not paid by ArtStation, but I only worked at Oats because of ArtStation. Because ArtStation has a function where you can type in the location. And what a lot of people don't realize is a lot of studios prefer to find artists that's local. Because you don't have to deal with visa and moving time and fees and all that stuff, right?
Right.
So I'm 99% sure that Neo just looked up Vancouver concept artist. Right. And I was one of the few that popped up. And then he just contacted us.
I know for a fact that, like, for example, Tim Miller over at Blur, you know, he just prowls sites like that and goes to, and he, that's how he recruits him. The old days was, they just come up and say, I need two lighters. Yeah. What's their credit list? Right? Like what movies have they worked on? Or this is back when I was in visual effects. It's like, have you worked a digital domain ILM? Okay, great. You're hired. Right. It's like, it was not.
So how do people start then if you had no credentials?
Like, because the thing is like demo reels were like actually sometimes really hard to make. Right. Okay. You had to get the shots, but you can only get the shots after the movie was out on VHS or that's how long it was. Or DVD. But the DVDs, now, the DVDs come out a few months after the movie's out, right? Yeah. And now it would take 2 years. So sometimes you work on a movie and you still have to wait 2 years before you can put it on a demo reel. It was really challenging.
Right.
But I think it's great. I think these sites are great, and I think you guys are using them, obviously. You're using them, and there's a lot of great art coming out of it, and we get to meet a lot of them. And so, and you can discover people that can't,
right,
would be hard to be discovered otherwise.
Or in THU, you meet a lot of people you knew on ArtStation,
right?
But you never know their faces.
That's true, of course.
Oh, you're that guy. Yeah. Oh my god.
Okay. I've been following your work for like a year or something.
That's
awesome. Really good to finally meet you in person.
That's so cool. Yeah. Well, that says a lot. And I know that when ArtStation first came here, they were like a startup two or three years ago, or whatever. And now like they've exploded.
Biggest art site ever.
It's insane, right? It's really cool. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining me, guys. Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Phil. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
And we'll chat again soon at the Oasis, I'm sure.
Of course. Yeah. All right. Definitely.
All right.